Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and I'm joined today by the incomparable Sam Astor.
It's great to be here.
Sam, we have what is, well, it's essentially a master class in global anxiety today, delivered straight from the headlines. The sources you provided give us this this exhaustive look at policy, markets, and cultural stress points, all sort of converging at the close of 2025.
It truly does. Our deep dive today is into the Wall Street Journal for Wednesday, December 17th, 2025. And what this single day's publication gives us is just a remarkable, comprehensive snapshot of the tectonic plates shifting beneath the global economy.
Yeah.
You've got high-stakes geopolitical friction, you have significant domestic policy tensions, and all these cultural dynamics heading into the new year.
And our mission here, as always, is to provide you with a really exhaustive, detailed report of every major article.
Not just the headlines.
Exactly. Not just the headlines, but the impact, the implications, what it all means for you, the listener. The goal is to walk away from this conversation just thoroughly informed about what's genuinely leaving the world, you know, beneath all the surface noise.
Mm-hmm.
And to start, we really have to set the domestic scene, because the initial economic snapshot is flashing some genuine warning signs.
We absolutely have to begin with the labor market. The delayed government report that was released this week, it painted a picture of underlying weakness that, frankly, contradicts some of the smoother narratives we've been hearing recently.
Okay, so what's the headline number?
The headline is that the U.S. unemployment rate rose to 4.6% in November. Now, while that number is still, you know, historically pretty modest,
right,
it is the highest it has been in more than 4 years.
Okay, so let's unpack this for the listener who's trying to understand the actual health of the job market,
because
we're seeing a severe seesaw effect here. The report showed, what, 64,000 jobs gained in November, which sounds okay.
On the surface, yes.
But that gain was preceded by a massive 105,000 jobs lost in October.
A huge loss.
And when you zoom out, when you look at the trend, the U.S. economy has actually shed jobs in three out of the past 6 months. That was June, August, and October.
Right.
That really shifts the narrative, doesn't it? It goes from a smooth, sustainable economic landing to something much bumpier and, frankly, a lot less certain.
And this is where we have to look past those top line numbers, because the deeper worry isn't the headline unemployment rate, that's the U3 rate, but it's the measure of underemployment.
Okay, that's the critical figure, the U6 rate.
That's the one, the U6 rate.
So tell us exactly what that measures and why that number is so much more concerning right now.
The U6 rate is, you know, it's the broadest, most painful measure of unemployment we have. It includes people who are working part-time but desperately want a full-time job.
Okay.
And crucially, it includes people who are so discouraged by their job search that they've just stopped looking altogether. They're called the marginally attached. And that U6 measure, it jumped sharply in November. It hit 8.7%.
Wow.
And that's up from 8% in September. So a 0.7 percentage point jump in just 2 months, that's alarming.
So that means that measure of underutilized labor is now at its highest level since, what, August of 2021?
August of 2021, exactly.
That is a critical indicator. It suggests that companies, you know, rather than doing mass layoffs, they're just unwilling to hire new people or commit to full-time roles.
Right. It creates this pervasive underemployment, longer job searches for the people who are unemployed, and it suppresses the leverage for those who are working.
It confirms a deep structural issue, not just, you know, a cyclical dip.
Precisely. And if we're asking what's driving this tepid, uncertain hiring environment, well, the fingers point directly at Washington.
I was going to say, policy has to be a factor.
It's the main factor. Joseph Bruce Wallace, he's the chief economist at RSM. He states it bluntly. He says, all roads lead back to policy out of Washington, D.C.
And he's talking about what specifically?
Shifting trade policies, so the new tariffs, and the ongoing immigration crackdown. He sees those as the key restraints on both labor demand and supply. The policy uncertainty is causing businesses to just pause, to hold off on hiring and investment.
And the crackdown limits the available pool of workers.
Exactly.
That sets the stage perfectly for our first major segment, the economic landscape. The signs of a broad slowdown are really unmistakable, and they seem to be affecting everyone from the factory floor right to the kitchen table.
That's right. When we look at retail sales, which is, you know, the core measure of consumer confidence and spending power, U.S. sales were flat in October.
Flat.
And that was after just marginal growth in September of only 0.1%.
That's a huge deceleration. For context, U.S. retail sales growth had been averaging closer to a pretty robust 0.5% a month through most of 2024.
Right. So consumers are clearly dramatically tightening their belts as we head into what should be the busiest shopping season of the year.
And this softening isn't just limited to what people are buying. The business side is showing weakness, too. The Purchasing Managers Index data, it backs this all up.
It does. The S&P Global Flash U.S. Composite PMI, which, for the listener, measures both services and manufacturing activity, it fell to a six-month low of 53.0 in December. And that's down from 54.2 in November.
And crucially, growth slowed in both sectors. It wasn't just manufacturing. Services slowed down, too.
Both sectors. And here's where those tariffs we just mentioned start to bite really hard. Mm. New orders for goods, they fell for the first time in a year.
Wow.
And what's more, the rate of input cost inflation, so what businesses are paying for materials and services, it accelerated to its fastest pace since November of 2022.
And they're blaming that directly on the tariffs.
Directly. The chief business economist at S&P Global directly blamed the administration's escalating tariffs for this. And he noted that the border taxes are now broadening what he calls the affordability problem from just manufacturing
into services.
So
if I'm understanding this, tariffs make materials and components more expensive for manufacturers.
Right.
And that inflationary pressure is now seeping into the services economy, which is where most people work, because services providers also rely on equipment, on supplies, software, things that are now subject to higher costs.
You've got it. So businesses are facing rising prices, and at the same time, the consumer is getting squeezed because their wages just aren't keeping up.
What's the wage growth number?
Hourly earnings in the private sector rose just 3.5% year over year.
That's low.
Outside of the big swings we saw during the pandemic, that is the lowest rate of wage growth in several years. The implication is severe. You've got this combination of cooling wage growth, which limits spending power, and persistently high prices.
This is just straining household finances.
Terribly. It creates this generalized sense of disillusionment with an economy that, you know, promises prosperity but is delivering stagnation for the average worker.
That economic backdrop leads us directly to the Federal Reserve and this cloud of leadership uncertainty hanging over. The employment figures, the inflation concerns we just laid out, they're probably not going to significantly alter the Fed's current thinking on rate cuts.
No, the data validates the job market concerns that drove them to cut rates in the first place. But given the distortions from the recent government shutdown, this report probably isn't alarming enough to force their hand for, say, an immediate unscheduled cut in January.
But the politics swirling around the Fed, I mean, that's arguably more interesting than the policy right now. Particularly the prospect of new leadership.
It's fascinating. President Trump is set to interview Federal Reserve Governor Christopher Waller for the Fed chair position.
And Waller is known as a leading internal advocate for rate cuts this year. He actually dissented back in July, right?
Yeah.
In favor of a cut when the central bank held steady.
He did. He's got the technical credentials and the monetary policy leanings that you think the White House would favor.
You would think. But he's seen as a political underdog. Why is that? Why is the favorite among surveyed economists having such a hard time winning the political contest?
It's because the politics of loyalty, you know, they often outweigh technical expertise in this administration. Waller lacks the personal ties to Trump that other candidates have.
Okay.
And more damagingly, some in Trump's circle see him as disloyal because he voted for a half-point rate cut back in September 2024.
Which was before Trump was elected.
Right. And it was seen by some as an anti-market intervention at the time. It just demonstrates this preference for individuals who have proven their loyalty, even when you're talking about the most important economic institution in the world.
That preference for loyalty over, let's say, traditional policy expertise was really illustrated by Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent. He gave us this fascinating glimpse into the interview process.
He did. Bessent confirmed that Trump is, and I'm quoting, very, very deliberate in these assessments.
And he told that story about the president questioning one of the candidates on this first principles issue.
Yes, asking why the Fed employs so many PhD economists.
Right. And according to Bessent, there just wasn't a good answer.
Which highlights the administration's profound skepticism towards, you know, traditional academic economic orthodoxy.
It's not just a casual question, is it? It suggests a fundamental mistrust of the technocrats who manage policy. And that aligns with this broader populist distrust of established institutions.
And that skepticism feeds directly into the administration's own very unique economic model that we're seeing emerge.
Which leads us right into our next theme, state capitalism, tariffs, and corporate alignment. So what exactly does state capitalism mean in the current U.S. context? I mean, the government isn't seizing factories.
No, it's not nationalizing industries. It's a new hybrid model that relies on leverage rather than outright ownership. Under President Trump, the state doesn't own the companies, but it uses its substantial regulatory, trade, and financial leverage by taking equity stakes or slices of revenue or even what they call a golden share to steer corporate behavior toward national policy goals. It's transactional governance.
And the NVIDIA case is the perfect, clearest illustration of this transactional reality.
Absolutely. NVIDIA, a leader in AI chips, finally got permission to sell one of its most advanced semiconductor chips to China, a massive necessary market for them.
But the license came with a price.
A big one. The federal government will take 25% of the revenue from those advanced chip sales.
That's essentially a federal tax or a rent on market access.
That's exactly what it is. And the CEO, Jensen Huang, he basically accepted this license that used to be free because the alternative was being completely shut out of a hugely lucrative market.
I think he was quoted saying something like, "Whatever it takes to get it approved is fine with us."
He was. It just shows how companies are aligning with state policy not out of some deep conviction, but out of necessity for survival and profit.
But this kind of alignment can easily slide into something far more politically fraught, like crony capitalism.
Oh, absolutely. Where the government acts not in the broad public interest, but to serve the interests of favored capitalists. I mean, look at the Pfizer case. They agreed to lower drug prices and invest heavily in U.S. manufacturing. In return, they got tariff relief, a direct transaction favoring a policy goal.
And then later, when Pfizer was in that bidding war for an anti-obesity drug startup.
Yes, a Republican activist connected to Trump's inner circle publicly demanded antitrust scrutiny of the foreign competitor Novo Nordisk, alleging anti-competitive behavior.
And Pfizer won the bidding war shortly after that.
They did. Now, the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, he naturally insisted the FTC did what they thought was the right thing to do, and that it had nothing to do with his relationship with the administration.
But the optics are challenging. When these transactions align so neatly with policy outcomes, it's hard to ignore.
It's very hard to ignore. And those optics become even more strained when we look at the supposed primary goal of the tariffs, which was boosting domestic manufacturing jobs.
Which is demonstrably failing to happen.
It is. Since January 2025, manufacturing jobs have seen a net loss of 58,000.
58,000.
And this includes significant losses in critical sectors like motor vehicles and parts. That's 15,000 jobs gone. And basically flat employment in steelmaking.
So it directly contradicts the fundamental promise that these border taxes would produce some kind of manufacturing boom.
Completely. Instead, businesses are either dealing with higher input costs, or they're automating and reconfiguring their supply chains to avoid the costs entirely. And the result is job stagnation and loss.
So we have a slowing domestic economy fighting against these self-imposed policy hurdles that appear to favor certain corporate players over broader market health. That takes us seamlessly from the economics of domestic leverage to the geopolitics of control. Let's widen the aperture to our geopolitical fault lines, starting with a critical global choke point: China's hard bargain for the Panama ports.
This is a massive high-stakes negotiation with direct implications for U.S. consumers and national security. You've got BlackRock and Mediterranean Shipping Company, or MSC, leading a $22.8 billion deal to buy dozens of global ports.
Including the two massive container ports right at the Panama Canal, Balboa and Cristobal.
Exactly. And the significance of this deal is really rooted in who owned them before, the Hong Kong-based CK Hutchison.
Right, and the U.S. government initially pressured for this sale because of acute national security concerns about Hutchison's connection to Beijing and their control over this critical infrastructure. The whole goal was to remove Chinese influence.
That goal has been entirely frustrated. The deal has now hit this intractable impasse because Beijing is using its regulatory power to force its way back in.
How are they doing that?
Well, China initially pushed for its largest shipping company, COSCO, to be brought in as an equal partner. Now, the demand has escalated.
To what?
China is demanding COSCO receive a majority stake and, crucially, veto rights in running the ports.
Which the White House has said is a complete non-starter.
A bridge too far. BlackRock and MSC find it unacceptable, and Washington has stated that Chinese control of the Panama Canal, quote, violates the U.S.-Panama Treaty and jeopardizes our national and economic security.
But China clearly believes it has immense leverage here.
It does. China's Commerce Ministry has asserted its right to review all global deals, and they often hold these deals hostage, sometimes insisting on changes that appear, you know, politically motivated.
And all the parties involved, BlackRock, Hutchison, MSC, they all have massive business interests tied to the Chinese market.
That's the leverage. China can use regulatory pressure on those businesses globally to force this deal through.
And the economic stakes for the U.S. are just enormous. We're talking about supply chain vulnerability for the entire hemisphere. Millions of U.S.-destined containers pass through those ports.
Over 40% of all U.S. container traffic uses the Panama waterway to ship goods between Asia and the Americas.
So if China gains majority control and veto rights, it gains the power to slow, prioritize, or even stop traffic at will. It's a strategic choke point in a time of friction.
Beijing is aiming to make control of these ports a powerful negotiating chip in broader U.S.-China talks over trade and tariffs.
Moving from one geopolitical flashpoint to another, let's talk about Venezuela, blockades, and the rules of war.
Right. President Trump has ordered a total and complete blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers entering and leaving Venezuela. It's a dramatic escalation of the pressure campaign on the Maduro regime.
And this move references a large U.S. armada deployed nearby. The president boasted that this was the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America.
Heavy rhetoric. And the immediate impact has been dramatic. The threat has caused the number of vessels waiting off Venezuela's coast to drop from around 45 to about a dozen. Vessels are just making immediate U-turns to avoid being stopped.
But ordering a total blockade, especially involving a large military presence, that has serious international law implications. What are the legal risks here?
The risk is enormous. A full military blockade under traditional international law is generally considered an act of war.
It's a violation of the UN Charter unless it's in direct response to an armed attack.
Right. But the administration appears to be navigating a kind of legal gray area here by targeting only sanctioned vessels.
And how does targeting only sanctioned vessels let them sidestep that definition of an act of war?
Well, by targeting sanctioned vessels and intentionally excluding companies like Chevron, which operates under a specific license exempting it from sanctions, the U.S. is trying to frame this as an enforcement action.
Not a blockade.
Right. An enforcement action related to drug trafficking and economic sanctions, rather than a generalized full-scale economic blockade, which international law is much stricter about.
But the language, total and complete blockade, and the deployment of a military armada, that certainly signals a transformation of the war on drugs from a metaphor into a reality.
It does, and it raises serious legal questions about the use of military force against alleged drug smugglers on the high seas.
This tension between maximum force and legal adherence is really amplified by the controversy around Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
Absolutely. He has flatly refused to release the full, unedited video of a September 2nd strike on alleged drug traffickers, despite bipartisan calls from Congress to do so.
And lawmakers familiar with the footage say it reportedly shows two survivors of an initial airstrike clinging to the wreckage of their boat.
Before being killed in a second attack.
And the Pentagon's rationale for withholding the footage is purely technical. They claim releasing it would compromise sensitive military operations, like revealing the specific aircraft model used.
Which is a rationale that just pales in comparison to the ethical questions raised by the alleged content of the video itself.
And this is where we have to look at Hegseth's own controversial views, because they really set the climate for these command decisions.
He's been pushing for maximum lethality, not tepid legality. He's authorized the firing or transfer of top military lawyers who he called potential roadblocks to orders.
So an opinion piece argues forcefully that whether or not Hegseth directly ordered that follow-up strike, he created the climate in which the commander on the ground made the decision to do it.
Exactly. He's setting a tone that fundamentally disparages the laws of war. And the laws of war aren't just, you know, technical rules for engagement. They're designed to protect the professional integrity and the soul of the soldier, as St. Augustine once wrote.
By setting clear lines against the love of violence and revengeful cruelty.
Right. To minimize excesses. The implication here is profound. When the Secretary of Defense questions the role of legality, he challenges the very structure designed to prevent unjust, potentially criminal, actions against defenseless individuals.
It puts immense pressure on commanders operating in ambiguous environments, and it's cited as the context for why that second strike against survivors may have been ordered.
And it creates this dangerous cycle. Legal advice gets dismissed, which leads to ethically questionable strikes, and then the evidence of those strikes is suppressed in the name of operational security.
Let's pivot to Europe, where this geopolitical pressure is finally translating into a strategic and economic shift.
A huge shift. For years, European officials, especially in Berlin, were reluctant to acknowledge the existential threat posed by Putin's aggression. They preferred to focus on economic engagement.
And now there is palpable urgency. You have officials from NATO Secretary General to the British military chief urgently warning that Europe must be prepared for war with Russia.
And not just any war, the kind of total exhausting war our grandparents or great-grandparents endured.
This reflects a new, grim recognition of the danger. It's driven by Russia's growing military capability and boldness, and maybe just as powerfully, the deep worry that President Trump may follow through on demanding Europe pay significantly more for its own defense.
Or even threaten to withdraw U.S. security guarantees entirely.
But this urgency hits a tough fiscal wall, doesn't it?
A very tough one. European governments face immense political difficulty raising defense spending. Their populations are aging, social welfare systems are deeply ingrained and unreformed, and national debt is high after all the pandemic-era spending.
So European voters basically have to choose if they are prepared to sacrifice some politically popular welfare benefits, pensions, healthcare to guarantee national security. That is a massive political lift.
It is. And this geopolitical alignment is also driving a complete economic pivot in Germany, which has long been Europe's industrial powerhouse and its staunchest defender of globalization.
Germany is moving away from its deep economic partnership with China and now publicly questioning the merits of unfettered free trade.
The entire relationship has fundamentally reversed. For two decades, Germany supplied the high-precision machines and expertise that China needed to build its industrial base. China was the customer, Germany was the provider.
And
now China is rapidly innovating, and German manufacturers are pushing Berlin to protect them from cheaper, faster, and increasingly better Chinese rivals.
We have concrete data that proves this relationship has flipped.
We do. Germany has lost its global market share lead to China in key areas like general industrial machinery and electrical equipment. Total German exports to China have fallen 25% since 2019.
Meanwhile, imports from China have rocketed,
leaving Germany with a record trade deficit with China projected to be around $102 billion this year.
That is the sound of Germany realizing it helped build its own primary competitor.
And the fading of Europe's most influential free trade voices is powerful evidence of how the global economy is fracturing amid this systemic competition between the U.S. and China.
The pursuit of economic stability is driving former free trade bastions toward protectionism.
That's it, exactly.
That structural fracturing sets us up for our next segment on corporate turbulence, where geopolitics and domestic politics are colliding with boardrooms in truly fascinating ways. Let's start with the Warner Bros. Discovery Media deal.
So Warner Bros. Discovery, or WBD, is preparing to recommend its shareholders reject Paramount's latest offer,
which is a $30 per share all-company bid.
Right. Instead, WBD plans to recommend shareholders support its existing deal with Netflix. That deal is valued at $27.75 per share, but it's only for WBD Studios and the HBO Max streaming business.
It is genuinely remarkable that a public company would recommend the lower-valued, narrower deal over a higher all-cash offer.
It is.
It suggests that the cost of pursuing the higher bid is calculated to be far greater than that $2.25 per share difference. Is WBD effectively admitting that fighting the political risk attached to the Paramount deal is just too expensive?
They are essentially calculating the regulatory risk as a massive discount on the Paramount bid, and that high regulatory risk is tied directly to President Trump's desire to see CNN, which WBD owns, change ownership.
Of course.
Paramount's bid is championed by CEO David Ellison, who has offered assurances to Trump administration officials that he would make sweeping management changes at CNN, a regular high-profile target of the president's anger.
And Ellison's bid is largely backed by his billionaire father, Larry Ellison, a prominent and vocal Trump supporter, which only heightens the political optics of the whole thing.
Right. The irony is that even Jared Kushner's Affinity Partners, which was an equity investor in Paramount's offer, they pulled out. They cited a change in dynamics.
Which perhaps reflects the sheer complexity and political headwinds this deal faces.
I think so. An opinion column warns this whole situation is shaping up to be another Warner Bros. Travesty.
They're comparing the political intrusion to the prior antitrust suit that wrecked the AT&T Time Warner deal during the first Trump administration.
Exactly. The column reminds us that the courts ruled against the government's arguments back then, finding them speculative and unsupported, which strongly suggested the initial suit was brought due to political animus towards CNN.
So the precedent is clear. The administration has a history of weaponizing the regulatory apparatus for political aims against media companies it dislikes.
And WBD seems to prefer the certainty of the slightly lower Netflix bid, which avoids ownership transfer of the politically toxic CNN asset.
Now, let's switch to the high-tech world, where the political risk isn't the primary driver, but where AI hype is meeting a very low-tech reality.
Right, at CoreWeave. CoreWeave, which is a massive builder of AI infrastructure and leases data center capacity to giants like OpenAI, has watched over $4 billion of value just vaporize in 6 weeks.
The 48% share price plunge.
It's huge. And it's fueled by investor anxiety over a possible AI bubble and criticism from high-profile short sellers. But the direct trigger for the most recent sharp drop was almost comical in its simplicity.
It was heavy rains and winds in North Texas.
That was it. This weather event caused a roughly 60-day delay in pouring concrete for a major data center complex leased to OpenAI.
So you're telling me a rain delay wiped out $4 billion in value?
Literally. It just underscores the immense threat that construction delays and supply chain bottlenecks pose to valuations that are priced in across the entire AI infrastructure industry.
Billions of dollars in spending have been priced into valuations based on these promised very aggressive timelines.
And CoreWeave's CEO previously dismissed bubble fears. He argued that high demand for computing services validates the value. But the stock's gyrations highlight the fundamental fragility when a company uses high interest debt to finance massive physical buildouts.
They become hyper vulnerable to low tech problems. Weather, zoning, a concrete shortage.
Exactly. The digital economy relies entirely on a physical foundation that is slow, expensive, and subject to these mundane realities.
It's a powerful contrast. While CoreWeave is dealing with billions of dollars hinging on wet concrete, we see this very nascent investment activity happening in Silicon Valley high schools.
Right. Students like Tanvi Sivakumar and Liana Zhu at the Harker School, they're involved in a venture capital program learning to assess risk and apply investment theses by investing actual checks into startups.
It's an interesting exercise in learning risk tolerance. These teenage VCs are mentoring with industry experts, but they're focusing heavily on qualitative assessments.
Right, like assessing a founder's determination and ability to pivot rather than just cut and dry business metrics. Sivakumar, for example, woke up at odd hours on a family trip to Japan just to interview entrepreneurs for a biotech startup deal. They're learning the hard lessons early.
Albeit without the $4 billion weather risk.
Right.
Moving on to corporate restructuring, let's start with a classic American brand that is struggling, Kraft Heinz.
The company is replacing its CEO. Steve Killian is taking over ahead of the company's planned split into two separate entities.
And this shakeup comes after Kraft Heinz really struggled under the outgoing CEO, Carlos Abrams Rivera. They endured, what, 7 consecutive quarters of sales decline?
7. Demand is softening across key core products. Lunchables, Capri Sun, mac and cheese. They're just struggling for agility in a rapidly changing consumer market.
So the split is a structural maneuver meant to address this weakness. They're creating two more focused companies.
Right. The global taste elevation company that's high margin products like ketchup and cream cheese, and the North American grocery business, which will have Oscar Mayer and Lunchables.
And Killian, the former Kellanova CEO, he'll head the taste elevation business. He brings previous experience in corporate breakups to the table, so they're hoping he can spark some innovation and growth.
In another food industry headline, details emerged from a dismissed FTC lawsuit against PepsiCo that really sheds light on the immense power of mega retailers like Walmart.
The FTC lawsuit was filed in the final days of the previous administration, but dismissed by the current one. And it alleged that PepsiCo favored Walmart.
It did. And this is where the concept of the price gap comes in, which is crucial for consumers to understand.
So how did they allegedly favor them?
PepsiCo allegedly tracked rival prices, offered deeper promotions only to Walmart, and in some cases, tried to actively raise prices at other retailers, like the regional grocer Food Lion, to ensure Walmart maintained a competitive price gap with other sellers.
The idea being that Walmart has to be visibly cheaper to maintain its dominance.
Exactly. This practice highlights the common industry reality where large consumer goods companies carefully manage relations with huge retailers like Walmart, which can account for a huge percentage of their annual sales.
But how does this hurt the average consumer?
It creates regional price discrimination and it stifles competition. The practice effectively gives large retailers unfair pricing power, which in turn can force you to pay higher prices depending on where you shop.
The FTC had tried to revive enforcement of the decades-old Robinson-Patman Act, which forbids this kind of thing. But the current administration viewed the suit as nakedly political and legally dubious,
which led to its dismissal. And that dismissal essentially sanctions the status quo of asymmetrical pricing power, further cementing the dominance of the largest retailers.
We transition now into regulatory actions and social accountability, where Washington policy is having immediate personal impacts on families and individuals.
Mm-hmm. The Trump administration has formalized and massively expanded its crackdown on immigration, specifically targeting regions and demographics with a new travel ban expansion.
The ban now covers 5 additional countries: Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, South Sudan, and Syria.
And it adds partial bans on 15 others. In total, 39 countries, plus Palestinian nationals whose travel documents are issued by the Palestinian Authority, are now subject to full or partial travel bans.
That is a massive expansion, framed as formalizing the promised crackdown on third world countries. And the specific inclusion of Palestinians, alongside the expansion into troubled parts of Africa, signals a clear prioritization of political screening over traditional diplomacy.
Separately, Congress has punted a major healthcare issue, creating what's being called the ACA subsidy failure.
Right. Senate Majority Leader John Thune stated clearly that Congress won't be able to extend federal health insurance subsidies before leaving for the holiday break. It ends hopes for a last-minute deal that Democrats were fiercely pushing for.
So this inaction pushes any possible fix into 2026, meaning the immediate impact will be felt in millions of households right after the new year.
And what does the expiration of these subsidies mean financially for Americans?
It means higher insurance costs for millions of people who rely on them to reduce the price of coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The enhanced COVID-era subsidies are set to expire at the end of the year.
For an average family, this could mean premium increases of hundreds of dollars a month, an immediate painful financial shock in January.
And the political consequences of millions facing sharp premium hikes right after the holidays are going to be significant. Democrats, like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, argue that once those tax credits expire and premiums spike, it's going to be very hard to get the toothpaste back in the tube.
It sets up a major, emotionally charged battle in January 2026.
Let's turn now to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute fraud settlement, which is a truly sobering story about integrity in biomedical research.
One of the nation's top cancer centers, Dana-Farber, has agreed to pay a substantial sum, $15 million, to settle fraud allegations.
And these allegations centered on the use of inaccurate or altered data and images in grant-funded biomedical research and applications spanning a decade, from 2014 to 2024.
It's crucial to remember this isn't just internal malfeasance. The grant funding came from the NIH.
Meaning taxpayer dollars were directly involved. The Institute resolved the lawsuit, acknowledging that some of its scientists supported publishing more than a dozen articles in top scientific journals containing misrepresented data.
Things like duplicated or manipulated images used to falsely support research conclusions.
Right. It just erodes public trust in science.
So what steps is the Institute taking to mitigate this damage and prevent it from happening again?
Well, Dana-Farber has cooperated and is implementing significant corrective actions. This includes mandatory intensive training on research misconduct, new procedures for maintaining and auditing research data.
And they're using AI tools now, right?
They are. They're making AI-based tools available to screen manuscripts for errors and anomalies before they're even submitted. The hope is that technology can help catch what human reviewers missed or ignored.
And we have to highlight the role of the whistleblower here.
Absolutely. A molecular biologist named Sholto David initiated the lawsuit under the False Claims Act after flagging these irregularities. For his efforts and his courage, he'll receive 17.5% of the recovered money, over $2.6 million.
Which highlights the essential role of internal scrutiny in maintaining scientific integrity.
Finally, in the accountability section, we have this unprecedented source of insight into the current administration. The chief of staff, Susie Wiles, giving these candid assessments in interviews for Vanity Fair.
Wiles is famously reticent. She prefers to operate behind the scenes, but she was surprisingly blunt about the inner circle.
Her characterizations of top officials are quite explosive. They provide a crucial look behind the curtain.
I mean, calling Elon Musk an odd, odd duck who challenged the White House from day one with his impulsive style.
And describing him as an avowed ketamine user who sleeps in a sleeping bag in the EOB executive office building in the daytime.
While Musk has publicly denied drug reports, that description speaks volumes about the chaotic, non-traditional nature of the president's close circle of confidants.
And she also provided this fascinating psychological profile of the president himself, characterizing him as operating with an alcoholic's personality, even though he doesn't drink alcohol.
Because he believes there's nothing he can't do. Nothing. Zero. Nothing.
Which speaks to the immense confidence, or perhaps hubris, driving the policy we discussed earlier. The president later responded to this, saying he didn't take offense, essentially confirming the observation that he has a very possessive personality.
Wiles also weighed in on the administration's handling of the sensitive Jeffrey Epstein files, offering clarification on two key facts that have been the subject of massive speculation.
She did. First, she clarified that while Trump is in the file, she explicitly stated he is not in the file doing anything awful.
And second, she directly contradicted the president's public claims about former President Bill Clinton visiting Epstein's private Caribbean island. She said there is no evidence of those visits in the material she reviewed.
That kind of candor and fact-checking from a sitting chief of staff is exceedingly rare. It's a moment of genuine transparency into the personality dynamics driving this administration.
Shifting gears now, we move into cultural currents and the personal journal, exploring how these global pressures translate into personal choices and family dynamics.
Starting with something incredibly relatable for many singles burned out by the apps, dating becomes a family business.
That's right. Singles are exhausted. Fruitless searching and endless swiping have led some to completely cede control of their dating profiles to their family members, parents, siblings, hoping for new energy and a different perspective.
And this inevitably leads to wonderfully conflicting criteria, which is the source of the humor and the friction. We saw the example of Danielle Allen, who handed over her profile to her family.
Her mother prefers career-driven men who are well-dressed and meticulously avoid spelling errors.
Meanwhile, her sister prioritizes matches who are adrenaline junkies who can keep up with their intense hobbies, and her dad is looking for signs that a match won't be able to handle or butt heads appropriately with Danielle's headstrong personality.
Few profiles pass all the tests, of course. Danielle herself has had to veto some of her mother's choices, noting her mother tends to pick men in Gucci and more designer put-together apparel.
And Danielle immediately questions, how are they going to do on a hike?
Right. The generational and personality gaps are clear, but at least the family now understands how difficult the modern dating market is.
But the gamble can certainly pay off. We saw that in the Catherine Sturgill anecdote. Her mom, Ellen, suggested a match with a golf pro on Hinge.
And the mother's vetting process was driven by integration. She thought his profession would be a hit with Catherine's golf-loving father.
And 3 days later, the golf pro met the parents and immediately hit it off with the dad, talking golf. The mom concluded, "He dresses just like my husband," suggesting that comfort and ease of family integration often supersede the abstract criteria of the dating apps.
Next, we see a fascinating and painful counter-movement in family dynamics. The estranged parents push back.
This is the rise of the doormat mom movement. It's largely parents, mostly mothers, speaking out on social media and podcasts against adult children who have cut ties. They're trying to push back against the intense social stigma of estrangement.
They are resisting the notion that estrangement is automatically the parents' fault. They aim to build a community and feel vindicated.
Laura Wellington, who goes by Doormat Mom on TikTok, is a key figure here. She says she broke off ties with one daughter after realizing the daughter didn't genuinely want a relationship.
And her message is defiant. Parents shouldn't wait around for crumbs of attention or respect from their children, and it's not always the parents' responsibility to reconcile.
This phenomenon just underscores how common this pain point is. About 10% of the U.S. population is estranged from a parent or child at any given time. And mothers often struggle the most because they identify so closely with the role of being a primary caregiver.
But there is a powerful accountability counter-movement arising within this discussion.
There is. Liza Jeanette, who is estranged from her two daughters, sought therapy and started posting videos owning her past mistakes, specifically her anger, emotional abuse, and neglect.
She advises parents to stop fighting and listen to what their children are trying to tell them. She posts videos stating things like, "Yes, I abused my children, and I very well might be the problem."
She estimates 95% of her followers are estranged from their parents and seek advice on reconciliation. It shows that acknowledging and owning the fault is an equally powerful path toward healing, or at least self-acceptance.
Moving to a tragedy that shook Hollywood and raises questions about privilege, the Rob Reiner family.
Right. Rob Reiner's son, Nick Reiner, was charged with the first-degree murders of his parents using a knife.
An opinion analysis discusses how this horrific event profoundly challenges the simplistic Nepo baby label, the pervasive idea that being born into fame and wealth automatically guarantees an easy or successful path.
Nick Reiner, who struggled with drug addiction for years and even co-wrote a film about it, Being Charlie, which his father directed, he is cited as an example of a calamity baby.
A person whose privilege makes their failure intense, visible, and deeply public.
The analysis highlights that Nick's autobiographical film was starkly revealing about the pain and pressure in their relationship. The protagonist, the son of a celebrated actor-turned-politician, struggled constantly with addiction, using drugs to kill the noise of expectation and visibility.
The bleak insight is that while privilege provides opportunity, the visibility of failure under the glare of public recognition can compound personal trauma into calamity.
Let's turn our attention to global incidents that speak to rising anxieties. We must revisit the deadly Sydney Hanukkah attack.
This attack by a father and son motivated by Islamic State ideology left 15 dead, including two rabbis, at a Hanukkah celebration.
And this happened in a country often viewed as a model of multiculturalism, demonstrating that these threats are not contained geographically. The attack badly shook Sydney's tight-knit Jewish community.
And many expressed deep frustration that authorities had not heeded numerous warnings about a dangerous rise in anti-Semitism and radicalization in the country since October 7, 2023.
That failure to heed warnings, coupled with the tragic loss of life, creates an intense feeling of vulnerability and abandonment within the community.
In a vastly different context, we see how cultural codes clash fatally with Western liberal norms in the tragic honor killing of Ryan Al-Najjar in the Netherlands.
Ryan, an 18-year-old Syrian refugee, was allegedly murdered and drowned by her father and brothers after she began living according to Western liberal norms, choosing her own clothes, spending time with classmates, having a relationship with a boy.
Her attempts at ordinary assimilation were tragically treated as an intolerable breach of family honor. The sequence of events is profoundly troubling because she had desperately sought help. She fled her home barefoot, told neighbors she feared her father intended to kill her.
And she was placed under police protection, which was later withdrawn. This tragedy reveals a systemic blind spot in Western risk assessment. Police and social services often use generic domestic violence models that assume gradual escalation and individual actors.
But violence can erupt suddenly and collectively in response to perceived moral transgressions related to family honor.
And what's worse, police departments routinely categorize these honor-based incidents under generic domestic violence headings, failing to name the ideological motive. It creates a statistical blind spot that prevents effective policy intervention based on accurate risk profiles.
That is a powerful argument for candor in law enforcement and policy. Liberal democracies have to recognize when their values, like individual rights and autonomy, are being contested inside their own borders by cultural practices that conflict fatally with those rights.
Finally, let's wrap up the personal section with the story of memorialization and grief.
Justin Crowe's business, Parting Stone, offers a unique way to deal with loss. It turns all of a loved one's cremated ashes into 40 to 80 palm-sized stone-like art objects. The process costs about $2,500.
And this is a direct response to the inadequacy of modern grief rituals. Crowe started the business after his grandfather's funeral, feeling the modern death experience was too formal and distant.
His insight was simple but profound.
His insight was that families were hiding traditional anxiety-inducing urns in closets or garages. They were dealing with anxiety about the contents. By solidifying the ashes into this usable, holdable stone form, he realized it made death feel normal.
It provided families with a chance to create deeply personal rituals, like sharing the stones among family members or even sleeping with them under their pillow, instead of feeling obligated to hide an anxiety-inducing container.
It shifts the focus from disposal to ritualized remembrance.
That is a beautiful way to normalize an inevitable, yet often taboo, part of life. So looking across this entire deep dive, the economic deceleration, the high-stakes geopolitical standoffs, the corporate world undergoing painful splits and regulatory scrutiny, and the profound cultural anxieties, it's clear that December 2025 is a moment of intense convergence.
Absolutely. It's a moment where policy is trying desperately to keep up with reality. We see policymakers attempting to dictate corporate behavior through state capitalism, tariffs, political pressure, and attempting to dictate social outcomes through travel bans and the looming ACA subsidy failure.
But the market and society often defy that neat, structured imposition of policy.
They do.
Which brings us back to one of the most surprising threads we uncovered today. The fundamental fragility of the future we are building.
Mm-hmm.
We know the CEO of CoreWave, the AI infrastructure giant, dismissed bubble fears. He argued that high demand for computing services validates the company's nearly $9 billion value.
Mm.
But as we discussed, the biggest immediate threat to that valuation was simply rain, a construction delay.
So what does it mean for national strategic advantage and long-term economic stability when billions in infrastructure investment, the foundational physical layer of the entire AI technology race, can be crippled for 60 days by a low-tech nuisance, like unexpected weather and a concrete shortage?
It raises an important question for you, the listener, to mull over. Are we building our future on digital assets whose foundation is far more physically, environmentally, and logistically fragile than the digital expectations they support?
That gap between digital speed and physical reality, that's where the real systemic risk lies.
A truly provocative thought to end on, connecting the weather report to the national economy. Sam, thank you for guiding us through this deep dive.
Thank you, Alex.
And thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll be back soon with more insights from the headlines shaping your world.